And hello, everyone, and thank you for joining the Interoperability Standards Workgroup. I'm Mike Berry. I'm with ONC, and we are pleased that you can join us today. We have several guest presenters and discussants who have joined our meeting today, and we would like to extend our welcome and appreciation for their participation. As a reminder, your feedback is always welcomed, which can be typed in the chat feature throughout the meeting or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled at about 10 till noon Eastern time this morning. So let's begin roll call of our work group members. So when I call your name, please indicate your presence. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Arian Malik.
Good morning.
Kelly Aldrich.
Hi, everyone.
Hans Wittendeck.
Morning.
Thomas Cantalina. Christina Caraballo.
Morning.
Grace Cordovano.
Good morning.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Sanjeev Tandon, who is sitting in for Adi Gundlapalli. Sanjeev? Raj Godvarti.
Good morning.
Jim Georges.
Good morning.
Ken Kalmoto.
Morning.
Leslie Leonard. Hung Wu.
Good morning.
David McCauley.
Good morning.
Clem McDonald. Aaron Meary. Mark Savage.
Good morning.
Michelle Schreiber.
Morning.
Abby Sears. And Ram Sharam.
Good morning.
Good morning to all. And now please join me in welcoming Stephen and Arian for their opening remarks.
Well, thank you so much for kicking us off there, Mike. And thank you to all of the folks who've joined us as discussants today, as well as the members of the public. There are quite a number of folks. I think this is definitely our most popular meeting so far. So we're excited to jump right in. If we could go to the next slide. I want to start by jumping into our plan. As it were, how we're going to be approaching this today. Our focus today is on the health status data class, collecting as much information as we possibly can to inform the deliberations of our work group, to then turn those into specific recommendations back to the HITACH and the ONC for how to optimize this data class in the anticipated version 3 of US CDI. So on this slide, you can see, and essentially we've got this slide where it was sort of focused on our task 1A, but we're actually gonna be looking at all of these issues today. So ignore the light gray versus the black, but our tasks here are to evaluate the draft US CDI version 3 that was published by the ONC and to provide input, both with regard to the new data classes and elements that have been proposed for draft V3, as well as to other data classes and elements that have been determined to be at level 2, but have not yet made their way into the draft V3. So we're really suggesting out of all that's been proposed, what should be included in V3? Should it be more or less or different than what was proposed in the draft? And specifically, we're looking for potential opportunities to improve on the data classes and elements that were included in draft V3. Looking at how they are named, how they are organized, how they are defined, as well as opportunities to suggest representative value sets that may be used by developers and implementers as these are being implemented in the future. And then, as it says here under number 2, are there items within level 2 which have been determined to be functionally and technologically ready for inclusion in US CDI that perhaps should be included in the final V3 that were not in the draft. And then also looking for any barriers to the development implementation of these items that might suggest that indeed they might want to wait until a future version. So that's kind of where we're at. And our focus today will be on the health status data class, which is a new data class that's been proposed for draft in draft V3. It includes a number of data elements, and Mike is going to or Al is going to walk us through those. Some of these are data elements that have already been present in prior versions of USCDI that were suggested to be moved into this data class, and others are brand new. And I just want to contextualize this a little bit. I think we have a real opportunity here today to advance the interoperability of data related to health status, and specifically, as we will see, related to disability status, functional status, et cetera. And these are very important concepts. As a practicing primary care physician, I can tell you that I often lack this kind of discrete data for patients whom I'm caring for when they are being seen by other members of their care team. And it'd be wonderful to have that information available to me to be able to coordinate and integrate their care. Similarly, as an individual, you know, I'm currently experiencing some functional limitations related to some major orthopedic surgery I had recently. It would be wonderful if my physical therapist, my orthopedist, my primary care physician could share that information to stay up to date on, you know, the state of my needs, et cetera. So I think we have a real opportunity to move this data class forward. We want to do it as mindfully as we can, with as much detail and specificity as is possible, to reflect the tremendous work that's been done across the community on these data elements. But I would caution us to avoid, you know, restricting the progress of these data. I think that you know, what we've seen with USCDI is we can get items into the structure even when they are not, you know, 100% specified. And then the industry is amazing in its ability to go with that opportunity and to advance data elements, whether it's through additional standards, additional value sets, additional use cases, and implementation guides. So I think our job here is to see how good we can make this and hopefully keep it moving forward. Aaron, do you want to add to that?
Nope. I'll do that during the panel introduction.
Wonderful. So Al has offered to give us an introduction to the health status data class that was included in USCDI version 3 to try to put this into context.
Great. Thanks, Stephen. Next slide, please. As Stephen mentioned, and for all the reasons that Stephen mentioned, ONC introduced the health status data class as a way to reorganize some of the data, different data elements in USCDI version 2, as well as to introduce these new concepts that we were talking about. The new health status data class has as its definition a similar definition to the previous data element of health concerns, and that health status data class is defined as these health related matters of interest, importance, or worry. And that's a pretty wide range of scope for patients, their families, or their providers. So it includes two existing data elements that came from their own data classes. That's the health concern data element, which is a bit of a legacy data element that goes back to the Common Clinical Dataset before USCDI, as well as the smoking status that has been part of a requirement of certified health IT for actually going back to at least 2015, if not 2014. So those, because they are, these are sort of status check data elements or a way to express particular concerns. We felt like they fit into this more of a broad category of health status. The four new data elements that we introduced. The first one was one of them was pregnancy status, and we've been really sort of wrestling with how best to represent pregnancy status for a long time. Started really in earnest during the Zika epidemic. We recognized that it was important to be able to at least evaluate a person's status or potential status for pregnancy, which would shape our approach to caring for that patient during situations where a condition might interfere with or complicate pregnancy, or pregnancy might actually
affect the ability to care for a patient with another condition like Zika. So we added pregnancy status. The three that we're mostly going to focus on today are disability status and functional status, which are related, maybe two sides of the same coin. And they are typically a structured assessment for those areas, whether assessing function or actually assessing the lack of function or disability. And then mental function is a little bit of a one aspect of functional status, but it includes evaluations such as cognitive status, the structured and unstructured evaluations of one's mental function. And so in general, we felt like these fit into this category, the category of the health status. And we will hear debate about the best way to represent each of these data elements as well as the data class itself. But particularly related to disability, there's been a lot of feedback that we've gotten from this work group already and several stakeholders that are outside the work group is that disability is only one part of the to focus only on the, I don't know if you want to call it the negative aspect of disability, but it is a condition that affects a person. And but to focus only on the condition that affects a person without addressing how we approach taking care of that patient or person, we left a little bit of a gap. And so next slide, please. And so we also want to focus on being able to capture the other side of disability, which is the accommodations. And these are the definition that was actually submitted as a data element in USCI, and this is a decent working definition for accommodations from a clinical perspective, I feel like this can be thought of as sort of a treatment for a disability or an approach, a clinical approach or a treatment approach to a disability, and to provide for a patient that has a disability in order to improve their function or ability to cope with that disability. We actually did get a submission. Actually, Grace Cordovano was the one who submitted the accommodation data element in USCI. It was introduced and it was evaluated at a comment level, which means less mature. And the reason it was evaluated as less mature is because it didn't have associated standards or terminology associated with it. And part of that is because the accommodations itself can be thought of as a significant group of different items, and it could be a medication. And as I'm kind of skipping directions, but going to the middle bullet is the one way to look at accommodations is to look at it as a collection of different things that can be done or provided for a patient in order to address that disability, and this could be an order for durable medical equipment, a particular medication to address the disability, a treatment or procedure, or even just in more generic sense, a plan of care to provide accommodations to address that disability. And so that was actually one of the reasons why it's difficult to sort of put your arms around this accommodations, because it can be represented in a lot of different ways. And that sort of points to one of the ways that we can approach accommodations is do we already capture the essence of accommodations in these other data elements like orders, like medications, like treatments or procedures? Are we already addressing them with these various USCDI data elements? Or do we keep it as a separate data element and then try to put that data element together with all these different data types or these other concepts? I sort of leave that as an open-ended question, and we will get into it during our panel discussions. So this is one way to look at accommodations for disabilities and possibly signaling how we approach it with recommendations for USCDI data elements. And I will turn it back over to Stephen or Arian.
I got it.
To move on to the next section.
Let's maybe go to the next section. We have a fantastic panel lined up. or set of panels lined up. We could have filled the entire time and more with panelists. This topic has attracted a substantial amount of the passion and interest of the standards oriented and care planning and disability rights community. If we can go on to the next slide. You know, as Stephen said, this topic of disability status, functional status, cognitive status exists on a continuum. And all of us are going to experience some form of functional limitation, disability, cognitive impairment in our lives. You know, as Stephen sort of gave a personal reflection, I will give one as well. I personally am immunocompromised, secondary to a B-cell leukemia, for which I received active treatment about this time last year. B-cell cytotoxic treatment, and you know, despite multiple vaccinations, do not have a working antibody response. You know, I rock climb outside, I'm very fearful inside, and so you know, I've got substantial limitations to some aspects of daily living. On the other end of that continuum, my son has tuberous sclerosis, has had seizures since he was 5 months old, has a significant cognitive delay, developmental delay, and continues to struggle with epilepsy. He's going to require full-time care to complete activities of daily living, and he's going to require a substantial amount of both medical care and accommodation. And you know, I mentioned this to point out that all of these issues of disability exist on a spectrum. There's no binary on or off related to disability. It's something that that all of us will experience. It's temptation. There's a temptation to think that it's a status. That it's an inherent part of a person, but it's, you know, it's temporary. It exists on a continuum, and it changes over time. You know, also note that there's a substantial amount of self-identity sometimes is attached to these statuses. And because they're almost inherently normative or arrayed against, you know, some sort of normative baseline, there's a temptation to categorize these statuses as deficits. And because of that, there's a substantial amount of personal identity, associated with the documentation of these statuses. And again, just as a personal reflection, you know, how we approach these statuses really depends on what aspect of daily living we're talking about. When we're talking about my son and living as happy and productive a life as he possibly can, you know, he's a very joyful individual. We love being around him. But when it comes time to advocating for him in applying for disability benefits with SSA or applying for appropriate accommodations with the school system, you bet that we are going to describe his disability in as clear, accurate, and clinically descriptive terms as we possibly can to justify the appropriate amount of accommodation possible. So with all of that as preface and also underscoring Stephen's notion that we really want to advance the state of the art to better accommodate and better support again, this continuum that all of us will experience in our lives and make sure that the clinical infrastructure that we have, the interoperability infrastructure that we have better accommodates all of our health status. I'm really pleased to introduce our lead-off presenters. So Sylvia Yee has been a tireless advocate for disability rights as part of the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. As part of that role is an advocate for example, disability rights in the school system and in work. Bonnie is an epidemiologist who has been looking actively at how functional status and disability status disproportionately affects, for example, COVID response and health outcomes, and really is interested in the topic of how we better build systems of care and care for populations. Megan has been working better on the ground, better enabling electronic health record workflows to better document disability and functional status in EHRs as part of her academic work. And so I cannot think of a better panel to lead off and walk us through these topics and help us formulate recommendations. So Sylvia, Bonnie, Megan, over to you.
Well, thank you. I want to just first say thank you so much for sharing your personal perspective. That means an enormous amount. And thank you to the committee for inviting us here to talk about this increasingly important and long overdue topic. I'm Bonnie Lynn Sweenor, director of the Johns Hopkins Disability Health Research Center. And as was introduced, I'm accompanied by Dr. Megan Morris from the University of Colorado Disability Equity Collaborative and Sylvia Yee from Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. I want to start by recognizing the complexity of this conversation. By design, the disability community includes a broad group of people, as was just described so well. As disability advocates, data scientists, and researchers, we are here to help break down some of that complexity. There's often an imprecision in the terminology that we use to describe the disability community. Two people can use the word disability to mean two entirely different things. So when we're talking about data, we have to first start by being clear about what we're measuring and why we're measuring it. Next slide. The data elements being discussed today are measuring two constructs of disability, a social or demographic construct and a medical construct. Each can be linked to separate data elements, as shown on the slide. I want to highlight that that social or demographic construct of disability is often conflated with the medical construct. Much like a Venn diagram, these are separate, but at times can be overlapping domains. Data related to functional and mental status under discussion today fall under the medical construct and are important for clinical decision-making and care planning. But the disability data element assesses the social, demographic, and identity construct that was described again so well, and is akin to how we collect information on gender identity, race, and ethnicity. Similarly, it is important that this type of disability data be self-reported. Demographic disability information is needed to identify and address healthcare inequities and improve healthcare outcomes, such as quality, safety, and satisfaction for people with disabilities, and for closing gaps in healthcare access, such as via telehealth. This information is also needed to understand the role of social determinants of health, including transportation, housing, and food access, on healthcare outcomes for the disability community. And it can be used to help identify patients who might benefit from accommodations during healthcare appointments. Next slide. Recent national prevalence estimates from my center indicate that over 67 million Americans has a disability, and we actually know that's an underestimate. But that equates to more than 26% of our population, or more than 1 in 4 adults. What that means is that people with disabilities are the largest minority group in the United States. Next slide. Despite this high prevalence, people with disabilities face unaddressed health and healthcare disparities. People with physical or cognitive disabilities are more likely to have diabetes and heart disease. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities are 6 times more likely to die from COVID-19. Women with physical disabilities have lower rates of receiving preventive care, with only 54% receiving PAP tests as compared to 83% of women without those types of disabilities. And 1 in 3 people with communication disabilities delay their healthcare due to having trouble finding a provider and are 3 times more likely to experience a preventable adverse medical event. Next slide. The past 2 years have only magnified the health inequities that impact the disability community. Our national COVID-19 response has been limited because we do not collect this type of disability information in healthcare encounters and in healthcare settings. Data on race and ethnicity captured in electronic medical records has been critical to shed light on disparities in the pandemic response for those groups. But the absence of similar disability data has removed the opportunity for us to track COVID-19 infection, vaccination, outcomes, care, and equipment allocation among people with disabilities. We need this type of disability data to act on health and healthcare inequities that impact more than a quarter of our population. Next slide. To put it simply, we cannot improve what we do not measure. We must collect disability information along with other demographic data to improve the quality of health and healthcare, to track the effects of interventions aimed at addressing health inequities, such as during COVID-19, and to identify people who might benefit from accommodations, including in healthcare settings. The inclusion of disability data in health information systems really cannot wait. I'm going to now hand it off to my colleague, Dr. Megan Morris, who will outline evidence and specific recommendations.
Thank you, Bonnie. So I want to start this discussion talking about what evidence we have for documenting disability status in the EHR. First off, many people have concerns about whether or not people with and without disabilities will be offended by these questions. And I can assure you today that that is not the case. We've done interviews and focus groups and surveys of patients with and without disabilities. And overall, they say they are comfortable with disclosing a disability status, and they actually expect their healthcare system to be collecting information about their disability. Evidence of this, we did here in Colorado at UC Health, we did a pilot study in which we rolled out collection of disability status as part of new patient registration in primary care. Over the course of our study period, over 3,000 patients were part of this trial and were asked about their disability status, and no patients reported any concerns with being asked about their disability status. So we're just not concerned about that issue. There is a legal requirement to document and record patients' disability status and accommodation needs. So we have the Americans with Disabilities Act that states that all healthcare organizations need to provide accessible and equitable healthcare to people with disabilities. And the DOJ has released more recent recommendations and standards related to this as part of their barrier-free initiative for the healthcare setting. And what they say is, they reiterate all healthcare organizations need to be identifying and providing accommodations, healthcare accommodations to patients who need them. And to be able to do that, you first need to know who has a disability. And I'll just pause here. What I'm talking about accommodations, we're talking about items in the healthcare setting, such as height adjustable exam tables, such as voice amplification devices, such as large print or braille materials that again, assist individuals with disabilities to participate to their maximum ability in their healthcare. We had a grant a few years ago, and we interviewed a wide range of stakeholders, from policymakers to advocates to researchers to insurance companies to professional societies. And we asked the question, what are your top research practice and policy priorities for advancing equitable healthcare for people with disabilities? And across all of those groups and all of those areas, the number one priority was consistent documentation of patients' disability status, both in the EHR and in national surveys. And then finally, as mentioned, I lead what's called the Disability Equity Collaborative. And as part of this collaborative, we have a learning collaborative of 50 plus health systems and who meet every other week to talk about what they're working on and how they can advance equitable healthcare in their organization. And I can assure you that all 50 of those organizations are actively working at some level on how to better document patients' disability status. Now, unfortunately, not a lot of them have figured it out. We're all sort of working on this together. And one of we did interviews with them to really dive into understanding why is this so challenging? And part of what they have identified as challenging is the lack of policy and standards over what questions should be asked, what data elements should be in the EHR. And part of the reason, so because we don't have those standardizations, there's not a standard Epic or EHR build. And so many organizations are developing their own builds, and that is taking a lot of time and effort for them to figure this out. Again, as part of that Disability Equity Collaborative, we actually have a work group on documenting disability status. And Epic is actively involved working with us, and we have about 30 plus members, and we are working together to actually identify what are the standards that should be in electronic health records for, again, the data elements, but then how the EHR can be maximized to provide equitable healthcare. Next slide. So getting into the nitty gritty, what questions? So we could spend days talking about disability questions, but we're going to limit our discussion to these seven questions. And these seven questions are a combination of the ACS or the census question, and then the Washington Group question. The Washington Group is actually an international group of people who put together disability questions. All right, and so these are the seven categories. I won't necessarily go through all the different categories of disabilities, but again, we actually did research on these questions, asking patients, providers, and other stakeholders to identify what are the best questions we should be asking. And we started with, you know, kind of a blank slate, and we landed with these seven questions. And I will just one of the comments in the chat, just also recognize that disability does change over time. And so these questions, it's not a one and done deal that they need to be asked repeatedly and followed up, because again, disabilities can change over time. All right, next slide. So thinking towards future, we see there's a few elements that we would like to put out there as in future rounds that should be considered. One is a learning disability question, a question about mental health disability, and then a question about autism and social disability. So you see under learning and mental health, we do have some recommendations about what those questions could be. I think we're, as a field, still figuring out what the best question is for autism and social disabilities. And then also, again, going back to, there's an active discussion about healthcare accommodations. And these are, again, accommodations, we're talking about it, about accommodations that are provided in the healthcare setting that help individuals with disabilities participate in their care. And then also want to throw out caregivers. So healthcare organizations are actually legally mandated to also provide accommodations to caregivers. So for example, parents who have disabilities. And so we need to also be able to track the caregiver's disability as well. All right, now next slide, and I will turn it over to Sylvia.
Thank you, Megan. We're just going to this slide. There are a few things we recognize that about disability questions, and that there is no perfect question. We know that disability is a socially constructed concept. We have finally come to a place where many healthcare entities collect race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation and gender identity questions and information in the healthcare context. And we do so not because these personal characteristics are necessarily and inherently influential on health. We do so because these characteristics interact with the healthcare environment in multiple ways, and we can identify those ways with data. Disability can be seen as more complicated because the factor of disability usually does have a direct connection to health, but there is also an interaction with the environment. In this case, the physical, social, cultural environment in which healthcare takes place, that has never been captured well and cannot be captured without demographic data on functional limitations. This is what we mean by disability as a socially constructed concept. We know that not everyone with an impairment will identify as having a disability. For example, many older persons who have a newly acquired disability or a functional limitation don't necessarily think of themselves as a person with a disability, which is also why the questions that we've recommended are written the way they are. We acknowledge that language changes over time and is affected by cultural understanding and translation. But despite these challenges, people with disabilities, the disability community, needs to have this information collected and cannot be asked to wait any longer. Next slide, please. To go through some of the reasons for the urgency, one of the number one reasons is what we have gone through in the last 2 years and continue to go through now, with COVID-19 and the public health emergency. The lack of disability information negatively impacted access to personal protective equipment, vaccination prioritization, critical support persons, and the ability to recover health. Disability is not a diagnosis, and a diagnosis is not a disability. It is important to have detailed, accurate clinical information, as our co-chair Arian has said, but that clinical information still does not capture all aspects of functional limitations and needs. And I'll give one example that I went through a lot in 2020. My organization worked and received many complaints from individuals with disabilities who typically work with support persons and who need support persons, both for potentially for communication needs, for assistance with activities of daily living. When when COVID, as the pandemic swept across the nation, most hospitals imposed visitation limits and would not allow anyone to have a visitor with them. There was, however, no understanding that a support person is not a visitor. And there was no understanding that civil rights laws continue to apply even during a pandemic. And not having this information, you would have individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities who would have to go to the hospital, whether for COVID or for another reason. And a family member could not go with them. A support person, an essential support person, could not be with them, which then meant that their condition, their health, and overall would deteriorate greatly. We heard of an individual who, with developmental disabilities, who could not keep their mask on. Their family member who would typically be there with them and would be able to help them do that in a hospital environment was not allowed, and that person actually did die because the mask could not be there. They could not keep their respiratory mask in place. This is not something you'd necessarily know from a diagnosis, the need for a support person or that kind of assistance is needed. The same thing for something like the sequential and clinical and crisis standards of care, which were applied, that exacerbated the whole situation, because individuals with disabilities who were in health in hospitals, if their condition deteriorated sufficiently, they could, in a surge situation, be denied COVID treatment and denied respiratory treatment. So anything that would lead someone to have their health deteriorate, as well as even someone with a vision disability, because the sequential organ failure, the SOFA scores, relied on things like being able to respond to someone's eye movements, a patient's eye movements could be tracked, or their ability to respond to questions. All of that is affected by functional limitations, and the functional limitations are not in the electronic health record. The provider applying the and finding out the SOFA score, determining the SOFA score, could not know that there were disabilities that affected that score. These are things we heard about, that we were phoned about, that we heard directly from people with disabilities about. Going on to another reason is that a lack of disability demographic identification means less funding, less understanding, less inclusion, and greater stereotypes. It was very hard in California to get the state to understand the risk that home and community-based users in the community were under, because support persons were coming to their homes to assist with tasks where social distancing is impossible. We we leave unchallenged without demographic information the assumption that a poor health outcomes are inevitably linked to the fact of a disability and the belief that there is no such thing as a disability-related health or healthcare disparity.
I want to do an inserted time check. This has been fantastic. If you want to do maybe a quick cleanup, and then we can move on to the next panel.
I will actually, and I would actually like to move on to the next slide. I think you can go through this slide and certainly see the reasons why we feel that the inclusion of disability information is so vital right now. We wanted just to go on to our recommended action steps after all of this information that we've provided you. The very first action step is that we think it's very, very important to include a disability as these disability elements. It's important to include the Washington Group and the ACS disability questions in electronic health records as a demographic factor. Second, we want to ensure that we highly recommend that a patient reported data collection approach is used. Third, we recognize that this is a first step, that future efforts can and should focus on accommodations, but we won't get there without this first step. And many people in the disability community, many advocates have waited a very long time for a first step to be taken. And fourth, we support the use of disability data to improve clinical care and address healthcare inequities that have been so hard for us as advocates to establish. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So as I think everybody can appreciate, truly an amazing presentation and a presentation from the ground, really improving the lives of all of us in the course of our history. We're going to go on to Matt Elrod, who's going to talk to us about the informatics view of capturing functional disability cognitive status. So Max, quickly over to you.
Thank you very much. Next slide, please. So again, I'm Matt Elrod. I am a physical therapist. I practice part-time. My full-time job is I'm a clinical informaticist with MaxMD, where I try to help share information among clinicians and various users. Next slide. So I have three objectives today. What I'd like to do is I'd like to introduce everyone to something called the International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health, the ICF. I'd also like to talk about recommending alignment between the ICF and draft USCDI V3. And then finally, talk about recommendations or similar approaches between these various data classes and what's been used in social determinants of health. Next slide. So the ICF is a classification system that's brought to us by the World Health Organization. We know them well for the ICD codes, specifically ICD-10 that's used now. They also have other classification codes looking at healthcare interventions. But again, today, what I'm going to do is focus on these classifications of functioning, disability, and health. Next slide, please. So to start off, let me just tell you a little bit from a clinical perspective. Again, I'm a physical therapist. I view the world through mobility, how people move around and interact in their environment. And if we take an example of the ICF, or we look at the ICF, it's used to help describe people at all ages and all levels of ability, and even being able to help identify if they have any disabilities. What I want to do is tell you a story about Joe. Joe is a patient, we'll just say he's an individual that has shoulder problems. And these shoulder problems are preventing him from gardening, something that he enjoys. So Joe's here in the middle, there he is out walking with his dog. So he has no problems whatsoever with mobility. He can walk on level surfaces. And as a therapist, I need to be able to document that. And I can document that through clinical tests. I can talk about the problems that he has, these impairments of pain and mobility in his shoulders. I can talk about limitations of lifting his arms up. And I can talk about these restrictions he has in performing his habits or hobbies of gardening. Now, let's say a few months go down the line, and unfortunately, the common use case that people talk about is COVID. Joe gets COVID, and now he's admitted to a hospital. Now, we can use these same constructs, these same ways of describing his movement or his impairments. And let's talk about now he has impairments of a respiratory system, and he has impairments of generating muscle functions and endurance. He also has limitations of decreased mobility and his inability to walk short distances. So Joe has a long road ahead. Next slide, please. All of those words I just used to help describe Joe, they came from a construct of the International Classification of Functioning and Disability and Health. And this is a general slide that's shown a lot of times to talk about how there's these interdependencies between someone's health conditions or disease, their body's functions and structures, activities and participation, and yes, environmental factors. That's something that I've heard you guys talk about at the beginning of this call, about accommodations or things, as well as personal factors, things that can't be changed. The things that are in red are very clear constructs that the ICF helps to cover. Next slide, please. So here, what we see in this slide is really showing the some of the secret sauce, if you will, of ICF. And how do you look at ICF, or how does ICF help you understand in enabling terms, in other words, what someone can do, but then also describe disability or things that someone has problems with doing. And the ICF is built to do that. Next slide, please. So how is ICF built to do that? ICF has these components, as I've said before, the body function, structures, activities, limitations, and environmental factors. It has a hierarchical structure. This hierarchical structure has chapters, numerous chapters in each one of these components that you see listed over to the left. What you'll notice is you can then have various levels of more discrete information, and it can be moved down and down to where you have more specifics about how someone is moving around or interacting or functioning in their environment. Next slide, please. So let's go back to Joe for a minute. So to start off with, in the left side of the screen, you can see when Joe was, you know, just having an issue with his shoulder problems, that he had no issues with or disabilities related to his mental functions or mobility. There were no problems there. So we could talk about things about his health status and how he's functioning. But as Joe went and he now has COVID, now let's get into more discrete information about how we could share specifics about his mobility. Next slide, please. So if we start looking at this hierarchical model of ICF, and we talk about mobility, as you go down and you look at the chapters, these are just a representation of some of the chapters that are in ICF. You can talk about mobility. You can talk about walking and moving. You can be more specific in talking about just walking. And then you can talk about how he's able to walk short distances. Now, the key thing to remember here is it's not dependent on any specific standardized test and measure. I heard earlier that there's no perfect question. I would agree with that. There's so many instruments out there that are used in the physical therapy domain that there's not a perfect question that addresses everyone from either end of these spectrums and across all ages. But the ICF gives you a construct about how to share like concepts. Next slide, please. So this really gets us into talking about how you could look at this ICF framework and understand how it relates to draft USCDI. Again, as I mentioned, the ICF framework, it's operationally defined. It's something that's been out there for a number of years. It's used in clinical rehab communities, and it's very common verbiage that is used by physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech language pathologists. We use that in our education. And the terms are patient-centric. So when you use these words or talking about how someone is interacting in an environment, you have the ability to use words that are meaningful for a patient or their caregivers or their loved ones. We also have the ability that, and we know that there's payers and clinical communities that use standardized instruments out there, and I've listed a couple of them that may be well known, but all of their questions can be mapped back to ICF terms and domains in this framework. And again, it supports both functioning and disability. Next slide, please. So with that, what I want you to take away from this is if we can use a construct and we start looking at functioning. So if you roll up that mental status and the functional status, and we start using an ICF construct, we have the ability similarly to what was done with social determinants of health about how can you have this hierarchical structure to help share meaningful information regardless of where someone is in the continuum of care. So again, this is just a visualization of appreciating that structure of body or functioning, and then looking at body functions, and you could have mental functions, and you can even break that down further. And the same as I demonstrated earlier with mobility. Again, the ability to break that down further. And then finally, our last slide. So as we look at representing these functional things, you can do something that's very similar to what was done with social determinants of health. And social determinants of health, the concept of representing that, it occurs in many data classes within USCDI as problems, as assessment and treatments, and as goals. Similarly, when you look at functioning and you talk about that again, whether it's an enablement model of explaining where someone is, or a disability model about what problems they have, you can use in the data classes things like providing structured or unstructured information about how someone is functioning. That's key. It's key that it's not just a single standardized question. Again, these standardized questions that are out there and can be represented in LOINT or other ways, you can roll that up, or you can identify specific ICF codes and share that information to more clearly and succinctly explain how someone is moving around in their environment. You also can use these problems. You can identify these impairments, these limitations or restrictions on how someone is, again, functioning or what their disabilities are in their community. And then with the assessment and plan of care, I think of assessment as, and assessment's a word that gets very confused very easily. When I use the term assessment, I think about it as what goes on in between my ears. What is the clinical problem solving that I am doing to document what the problem is and now what my treatment plan is? Assessment, that word gets used a lot. Sometimes people use that to talk about the instruments that are used. But again, I'm clearly trying to say that this assessment of what's going on and being able to represent those things, we can use ICF terminologies to help us move forward in that world. And then finally, as we're talking about goals, about the patient's desired outcomes, again, you can use these functioning terms about, I would like to be able to walk on unlevel surfaces without having any problems. Again, these are ways that we can communicate very clearly and across multiple domains of how the activities that I do as a physical therapist can help support a patient. And then when I communicate to a physician care, a physician provider or other healthcare providers, I can use this common language and this common structure of information to help share those important pieces of information.
Matt, sorry for the interruption.
We're done.
Would you mind just going to the recommendations slide? And we have one more panel to accommodate as well.
The recommendation slide was already included. If cool. I went to that a little bit too fast, that was back a couple of slides. If you want to take a look at that again quickly, and it's a pretty clear recommendation of adopt the ICF.
Adopt ICF.
You got it. And then look at those others.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Apologies for the time limitations. This is a complicated topic that we're trying to do in 10-minute increments. So if we can go on to the next panel discussion. Thank you. Thank you for that. I kind of feel like Holly and Terry are rock stars and need no introduction, but I will suffice to say that both of them have been tirelessly working to improve interoperability in the domain of longitudinal care planning, geriatric care planning, long-term post-acute care planning. The list goes on, and have been at work to make sure that we have the interoperability needed so that our healthcare system works as a system longitudinally, as in addition to kind of its current functioning as encounter-based workflows. So, with no more fanfare, I'll just turn it over to Holly and Terry.
Great, Arian, thank you very much. And thank you to the panel for inviting us today. And thanks to the other speakers, that was really informative and very thought-provoking. We're gonna keep things a little more directed at reshuffling the chairs in the USCDI. So we're gonna touch on these four topics. So Dr. Miller and I will tag team on the presentation. She's going to do the color commentary and I'll do the play-by-play. So we're just basically going to propose that we retain health concerns as a separate data class, rename health status as health status slash assessments, and provide a definition for health status assessments, and then recommend some other standardized assessments that would be useful. And all of these fit within the construct that Matt had just presented. So next slide, please. Okay, so this is pretty easy. We're thinking that really health concerns really represent, to me at least, sort of a different concept than either a problem or a health status, because a health concern is really not objective in the sense that a problem or a status is or are. And then health concerns also require further action before it's defined enough to become either a health status or a problem. And that action is usually an assessment, not in the term that in the way that Matt used the assessment, but really assessment as a standardized process for evaluating the significance and extent and characterization of the concern. So it's, in a sense, again, it's different than a health status. And probably most importantly, from my perspective, is that health concerns really is the mechanism by which the individual or their caregiver provides input into the care plan. And it helps prioritize items to be addressed. There's really no other place in USCDI that this input comes in. So in clinical care, so I'm a retired geriatrician. The health status plays a different role than a health concern. And just thinking that moving concerns under health status confuses different concepts and downplays the importance of health concerns as the individual's means of directing care. So that's our pitch there. Holly, do you have any additional thoughts on that?
We can move to the slide. Thanks so much, Terry. And I echo Terry's comments about wonderful presentations, and thank you for inviting us. I think that the other thing with health concerns is it really indicates further workup is required. That it's not you're not at a problem, you're not at a health status, but there's a concern that requires more looking into. So go ahead, Terry.
Okay, next slide, please. All right, so this one's pretty straightforward too. Proposing that we rename health status to health status and assessments. And the reason for this is that, again, health status is a condition or a state of being. So you're pregnant or you're not pregnant, you're high risk or low risk for falls. So standardized assessments are the process by which health status is established. And there's no designated bucket, if you will, within USCDI where you can put the results of standardized assessments. So I don't think of those results as sort of a test result. They're different. It's much more of a process, I think. So some of the confusion, and Matt touched on this, arises because assessment in the currently existing data class assessment and plan of treatment is a different kind of assessment. It's really the clinician's conclusions based on the available data, and it's not in itself a process. So assessment and a renamed health status assessments data class would combine the process of establishing health status with the health status itself and provide a place for assessments within USCDI. Again, so on to the next slide, Holly, please add.
And I think in our discussions with Al around this and what Terry just mentioned, we're thinking of a standardized SOAP notes, subjective, objective assessment and plan, where the assessment is generally a diagnosis. And therefore really wanted this in a separate location with health status. So it became very clear that these were assessed, like standardized assessments that had been given for the patient that had a result or value.
Okay, so and so we propose a new definition for the health status assessments data class, and it's really, this is where you put a state or condition indicated by the results of a standardized assessment and compare it with problems and with health concerns with the current definitions associated with them. So the relationship of these three data classes, if you were, will, is really interesting because it's a very fluid, dynamic connection. So the connection between the health status and the health concern is an assessment, sort of an active progress. The result of an assessment, often done in the result of a health concern, is a health status, which is a state of being, such as pregnant or not pregnant. And the state can be different from the original health concern. So in this case, it might have been, am I pregnant as a health concern? And the health status is now either pregnant or not pregnant. And this new health status may in turn create a new health concern or problem. The concern could be either, am I pregnant when I didn't want to be, or am I not pregnant when I wanted to be? And the resulting problems could either be pregnancy or failure to conceive. So it might not be a problem at all. I am pregnant and I want to be, or I'm not pregnant and I don't want to be. So this is sort of a fluid relationship among these three data classes. And I kind of think of clinical care in this way. These are always in sort of a fluid relationship. So this leads to the final slide. Go to the next slide, please. And that's the data class itself. So on the left is what's proposed. And on the right, we have some additional recommendations. And the following three or four slides just go into much more detail on the recommendations. And they're not something we have to go into in any detail today. So we'll probably stop at the slide, but we just say that, again, we would take out health concerns. And the subclasses that are listed on the left, they're all important and they're excellent choices as initial set. And again, I think we all recognize this is a start. This is not the end of the long trail, but it's a great start. And these are all important. And functional status will need to include a bunch of other elements, such as mobility, incontinence, and ADLs and IADLs, and emphasize abilities. So there's an extensive list of commonly used functional assessments, and they're going to have a home somewhere within USCDI. So the functional status bucket will need to be large enough to provide a place for them. And disability status, I think, is important. And not so much for the reasons that have been previously given, although those are all important, but just that, you know, there's major sources of funding and payment within the US healthcare system that rest on disability. So Social Security, workers' compensation, VA benefits, these are all disability statuses, and there needs to be a very clean place where these constructs can exist within USCDI. And then as a geriatrician, you know, life is all about function and mental status, function and cognition. So mental status is going to need to be blown up as well to include cognition and mood and behavior. And so let's just stop there.
And so, just, sorry, if you could go on to the next slide, because I think that there were certain things we felt were critical
okay.
to be in transitions of care. There really were certain elements we thought were critical in caring for the patient. And I think the list in the previous slide is captures that. And this is just a little bit more detail on what we felt was absolutely critical for transitions of care to be able to adequately care for a patient, particularly in the LTPAC world.
All right. So I apologize. This is the classic thing of short shrifting the panels 2 and 3, because there was so much really amazing content in panel 1. But I think in the totality, we've covered just an amazing amount of ground. And so we're going to go to organized Q&A. As a reminder, we have, I think, about 15 minutes for overall Q&A. Before we go to public comment, depending on how much public comment we receive, we may be able to go back to Q&A. And Stephen has been tracking some of the comment and chat, and we've got a couple of folks who have raised their hand. So I'll go back and forth between hand raising and kind of bringing forward some of the comment in the chat. Hans, I'll start with you.
Sure. Two questions to two different panelists. First, to Terry. Welcome, Terry. Good to see you again. And Holly. Is that you're introducing combining assessments? With health status, there is currently an assessment and plan of treatment class as well. What are your thoughts on splitting that one up and moving the assessments together and have them all in one place in light of the arguments that you made? So that's one question. And the second question, if we have time, we can do that later as well.
Yep, sure. Thanks, Hans. Yeah, obviously, we think it makes a lot of sense to move assessments again in with the definition that they are a standardized process of evaluating a particular concern or status, rather than the, as I think someone mentioned in the chat, a state of art. So the assessment in the assessment and plan of treatment group is really comes from the old SOAP note and it's sort of how clinicians work. So they're two different concepts. So yes, I think we ought to move the assessments over. And I think, however, that would leave us with a nice bucket of plans. And when we get to the point of thinking about plans of care and treatment plans, we're probably going to want a place to put those as well somewhere in USCDI. So repurpose that data class.
Stephen, before I go into Raj, are there any sort of folks who haven't already raised their hand where there's an important comment that we want to bring forward?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there has just been a rich discussion in the chat. And I think most people have figured out that that they want to be sending their chat comments to everyone. All those chat comments that are sent to everyone are captured as part of the public record, are going to be made available as part of the minutes of the meeting. So thank you for that contribution. There was a specific recommendation early on in the first presentation about whether or not disability status or functional limitations belonged in this new health status data class, or whether they perhaps would better be suited to demographics. That's really largely an academic question, because as has also been discussed in the chat, it doesn't really matter where a data element sits in the hierarchy. It is still in the USCDI. So while I think there may be some reasons why we want to move things around, as Terry and Holly in particular have recommended, and as we will consider as a work group, the key is that we get things in the door. I'll also observe there have been a number of comments about the potential risks related to adding some of these data elements, that perhaps by measuring or sharing this data, this could indeed worsen inequities or disparities for certain patients. And I think that, you know, that's always a risk. These are data that are already being collected by some providers. I think having, you know, my personal feeling is that having them standardized and having a way to incorporate them into standardized exchange will net improve care. But we certainly do need to keep in mind that there are always unintended consequences that we should be watchful for. And I think David has had a lot of comments back and forth about, you know, the concerns that adding such things requires their measurement, which could then impact clinical workflows. And to be clear, just because something is in USCDI doesn't mean it must be collected at any given clinical encounter. But if it is collected, it provides a way to standardize that data and its subsequent sharing.
Yeah, I wonder, Stephen, just on the topic of introducing the opportunity for discrimination, if we might go to panel one and get a very brief response. And Sylvia, Bonnie, Megan, whichever of the three of you, maybe Sylvia, just from your disability rights, with your disability rights hat on, I wonder if you could very briefly touch on the subject of balancing collecting data to improve care and health and serve for advocacy versus the risk of future discrimination. And I know that's a complicated topic to go over in a one sentence answer, but I just wonder if you could briefly comment.
If I were forced to one sentence, I would say that we do have protections that we can put in place. Protections are very important, particularly in an age of electronic, you know, of artificial intelligence and algorithm use, et cetera. But without this data, we can't even track existing discrimination. We aren't in an ideal status quo right now, so as to let's not disturb anything and let's not introduce more discrimination. We are in a place where there is discrimination and we need to capture it.
Thank you very much. That's super, super useful. Thank you. Okay. So Bonnie also comments that we do more harm by not collecting this data. And again, she really approaches this from the perspective of epidemiology, particular to discrimination. We're going to go to Clem. Clem, there you go. Nope. Clem, you're still muted.
I'm sorry. I fully support Terry's idea about, you know, the assessment in a plan and assessment is quite different from an assessment where it's actually an assessment. It's actually a survey instrument or a collection of stuff that's been as verified and validated that you can kind of see a scale on it. So I'm for that. But I don't agree with emphasizing making a separate creature called the concerns over a problem, because I think Weed's original definition actually included anything anybody was worried about. Provider or patient would be a problem. And I think the burden is going to be hard to manage both of these lists and, you know, when is which is a what, you know. If patient has a heart attack, that might be a concern, you know, but it's also a problem. I mean, I just think it's going to be hard to sort that out. And we're not maintaining problem lists perfectly yet anyway. And so we add another list. I don't know how it's going to work out. Just a thought.
But Clem, I'll just remind everybody that health concerns actually not part of our remit because it's already part of USCDI. That's pre-existing. David, over to you.
Thanks, Arian. My question is maybe to any of the panelists who would like to respond, but it's about the adequacy of a simple structured assessment as a starting point for capturing some of this information. We've had debates in our panel in the past about the relative merits of capturing free text, full complete sentences describing a situation versus capturing some kind of a structured assessment. And I was impressed with some of the example assessments that you showed, that they were simple enough to be not overwhelming, but I wonder, are they adequate for capturing the information that you are recommending we should be capturing. So just a broad thought about the current state of assessments. Are structured assessments a good starting point, or should we stick with text for the time being and then structure it later?
This is Terry. Short answer, yes, they're adequate. And they're, unfortunately, there are thousands of them, all validated, standardized.
And as I noted in the chat, we have the opportunity, and ONC has done this already within this data class, to identify, for example, you know, that this sort of an instrument or this particular instrument would go into this new data class. And I think that there's value in that, as outlined in Terry and Holly's slides. We did some of that work last year with SDOH assessments, identifying specific LOINC instruments that could be used. I think that if we do that, ONC has the option of including that level of specificity in the V3 specification.
I completely agree. And I'm sorry, to Arian's point, that makes them codifiable and interoperable. So that's what we're shooting for as patients transition, for that information to go with the patient.
So we have 3 minutes to public comment, and I want to get some of these hands down. Alexis?
Yes, hi. I have a concern over including assessments into the health status. Not all assessments, whether we're talking about standardized assessments or even just a provider's assessment of the situation without using a standardized test, will classify a diagnosis or a health status for somebody. And those are still true problems for a patient or even a concern brought up by a caregiver. So I'm not sure that lumping together your health status based on an assessment, again, either standardized or just an assessment as an observed provider, really makes sense, because that's going to disqualify a whole bunch of people who have real problems, legitimate concerns, and diagnoses that are not diagnosed yet, and particularly, you know, those with rare disease and other things that haven't been diagnosed. So I think putting it into status doesn't make sense, because your health status could still be very different from what is shown up by an assessment, and especially a standardized assessment. And then my other piece I would just say is to the problems versus concerns. And it would be very opposed to the idea of saying that a patient concern is not necessarily an actual problem. And I think when we talk about discrimination and patient voice and not taking into account what's happening with the patient at the moment, considering something a concern and that it's not necessarily a problem is very subjective to the person who is evaluating that. And I really think it's that we walk a slippery slope by saying that it's a concern isn't necessarily a problem.
Thank you. Grace?
I'm trying to see if there's any benefit. There's a lot of work done with Social Security disability benefits. Is there any way that that could be added to the work that's being included in draft or proposed for inclusion draft B3 to help enhance these conversations about health status, for example, disability status, functional status? Would capturing and, you know, linking that information here be helpful?
Grace, I had exactly the same thought, because I've been through the pain of trying to justify or document disability status with Social Security. I believe the way that this is going to happen is that work will go through USCDI Plus. And I would be hopeful that the work that we're doing here advances the cause. I think we know right now that a consolidated CDA out of the box doesn't fully address all of Social Security's concerns, and that they published an implementation guide for CDA-based data collection that does get the full documentation required for disability determination.
Okay, let's hold the remaining questions and go to public comment. I know a number of folks from the public are looking forward to sharing some ideas with us, and then we'll come back to the raised hands.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. And we're going to pause now and open up our call for public comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute or unmute your line. So let's pause here to see if we have any raised hands. And I see Michelle, forgive me if I pronounced your name incorrectly, Michelle Doherty or Doherty?
Doherty, thank you.
Thank you, go ahead.
Thank you. So my name is Michelle Doherty. I'm a senior health informaticist with RTI International. My background includes 15 years of experiencing advancing interoperability to support aging and disabled populations, to identify gaps in the interoperable data classes and proposed data classes to address the important healthcare needs of this population. So related to the focus of today's workgroup meeting, I have submitted comments on the gaps in around function, mental status, disability status, and early iterations of the Common Core data for interoperability. I've also proposed data and standards that are included in the Interoperability Standards Advisory, and proposed the functioning data class that is currently referenced in V3 for mental status and aligns with the functional status proposal that is currently in V3 that Dr. Miller submitted. So with that background and context, I'd like to relay some following comments around the presentations today. And first, appreciation for the expertise and recommendation of all the presenters that are informing this important work for the consideration, you know, by the work group and their recommendations. Second, just to support Dr. O'Malley and Dr. Miller's presentation and proposal for the data class to be renamed to focus on health status and assessments. In work that I've done around the functional and mental status area and trying to differentiate between observation versus problems, I just wanted to note that I felt agreement with their recommendation that is health status more aligned with problem and therefore perhaps not part of this heading, you know, and I understand the limitations as well. And then also agreement with SDOH items, which are often based on screens and status information, and potentially there's some better alignment in the health status assessment class that's being discussed today. Also to address a comment that came in today around the current assessment and plan of treatment, I would like to express my support for updating that naming to something that was brought out here today as plans and treatments. So for example, that could address care plans. It could address treatment plans and orders, areas that are gaps that we've identified in our analysis of USCDI and the current classes that have been submitted. I just two final comments. One is to endorse Matt Elrod's presentation on the use of ICF as an organizing framework for this in the functioning space. We've worked together on the PASIO project. It's a FHIR work group. And as well, I work on the CMS Data Mountain Library Health IT work group. And so as part of the team that's supporting the development and evolution of the kind of functional and mental status FHIR implementation guides, we've worked with the kind of FHIR work group, the community meeting, and we hit challenges that were really significant in the difference of opinion based on clinical expertise when discussing functioning and how it should be organized and how it could be expanded over time. But when the framework of ICF was brought into the discussion, it provided a credible, well-researched organizing structure for the IG as well as future expansion. So I wanted to share that experience and how it helped bring consensus to the work group and a path for future.
Thank you.
I also wanted to note that
we're at time right now for the 3 minute public comment. Thank you so much. Who's up? Who's next up?
I do not see any other hands raised for public comment at this time, so I'll turn it back to our co-chairs.
Okie doke. Why don't we go to Ike?
Thank you so much. I think listening today's conversation makes me really think we need both some structured and unstructured data elements. Really looking at an unstructured data element to account for assessments that are being undertaken right now, really looking at individuals with rare conditions, among others, because it's going to be a very long time before we can get every assessment across every condition codified with standard results. But the ability to share that specific assessment information across the care team for those individuals really becomes important as we're looking at shifting information between physicians and social workers and physical therapists and the like. And I think having that flexibility would be really, really important. Having some structured data elements to at least communicate high level needs as a starting place would also, I think, be helpful and be able to help us sort information or categorize information at a broader level. But I think we need to look at this as an evolution. We're going to eat this elephant one bite at a time and not in one big mouthful.
Yep. Thank you for that. And I just want to remind everybody, because there's been a bunch of discussion on this, that in many ways, what we're talking about is pairing a LOINC code with a slot, with not a ton of, with no in USCDI determination of what's in that slot. And so that overall construct can serve both structured assessments and questionnaires, as well as unstructured observations or patient observations or self-assessments. And so that's kind of the place that we're at is, hey, let's just have a pairing of a LOINC code and a slot, as opposed to the ability to capture all the detailed information that comes out of an assessment. I'm going to turn it over to Mark for a question.
Thank you. First, so grateful to the three presentations and the presenters. Just amazing. Second, I'm glad that the work group and ONC staff will be curating the chat, because there are some really important comments in there to be folded in. Lastly, to my clarifying question, the first presentation really emphasized the importance of self-reporting on disability status. I didn't discern from the ICF alignment that was a self-reporting. It seemed more like an observation. I just wanted to confirm, because self-reporting is critical here.
So this is Matt Elrod. I'll address that. And ICF is absolutely used for self-reporting as well as for clinical observation. It can be used in multiple constructs of a patient-reported outcome instrument, and it can be used to represent those identified problems from the clinicians.
Thank you, Clem.
Thank you.
We have 2 minutes, we got to wrap up because we're at time. So go ahead, Clem.
Oh, thank you. So I'd like to kind of follow up on Terry's comment about, there's thousands of these surveys. They're quantitative. So I think the issue is, I think we should be doing, questionnaires and survey instruments that are validated, because they provide a quantitative thing, especially if they're not monstrously long. But we ought to pick them, because then the thousands of them really inhibits the use of them, and it makes a really problem for comparing. So there should be some effort to say, for this purpose, this one or these two are really good. I don't know how we can get to that, because it's been a problem for a long time. And of course, it's very competitive, and sometimes they're charged for. But we really should, having a standardized instrument where you get a quantity, I think is way better than an assertion of something or other.
Yeah, and I think we heard from the first panel that if we do nothing else, the Washington, ACS Washington assessment is the one to use. But I'd also comment that in USCDI land, we're sort of blissfully unconcerned with the actual assessment, because we get to parameterize that to a LOINC code.
We are at time, exactly.
Yes. It's been fantastic.
And we want to thank everyone for your presentations, for your comments, for your discussion. We will assure the work group that we will come back together next week and dig down into the specific recommendations that have come out of these presentations. We continue to invite all of you to capture your comments in the spreadsheet, and we will return there. I also just want to make a comment comment that Hans has done tremendous work fleshing out our spreadsheet regarding mapping to the various standards, including fire, and we will go through that next week as well.
I just want to thank the panels. Truly an amazing day. Hopefully everybody has learned a ton, as much as I have. We will, as Stephen says, we'll take the output of this and turn it into work and recommendations via our usual mechanisms. So thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Thank you all.
Bye.